And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change. Just a programming note that this is the first of a two-part conversation I had with the Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon. Look for part two in an upcoming episode. And as is our custom, we will provide any web links that we discuss in this conversation in the programming notes and on the blog bendersoftheark.com. I hope you enjoy the show. Good morning, May Elise Cannon. Thank you for meeting with us this morning.
It's good to be with you, Jeff.
Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon is the Executive Director of Churches for Middle East Peace and an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Covenant Church. Cannon holds an MDiv from North Park Theological Seminary, an MBA from North Park University School of Business and Nonprofit Management, and an MA in bioethics from Trinity International University. She received her first doctorate in American history with a minor in Middle Eastern studies at the University of California, Davis, focusing on the history of the American Protestant Church in Israel-Palestine, and her second doctorate in ministry and spiritual formation from Northern Theological Seminary. She's the author of several books, including the award-winning Social Justice Handbook, Small Steps for a Better World, and editor of A Land Full of God, Christian Perspectives on the Holy Land. Her work has been highlighted in the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, Chicago Tribune, Christianity Today, Leadership Magazine, The Christian Post, Jerusalem Post, EU Parliament Magazine, Huffington Post, and other international media outlets. That's quite a list, May, but thank you very much for being with us here.
I'm happy to be a part of the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, what can you tell us about the origin and work of Churches for Middle East Peace?
Churches for Middle East Peace, this year is commemorating our 40th anniversary. So we were founded in the 1980s by a group of churches that felt that they didn't have the capacity to be experts on the Middle East. And so they wanted to consolidate their resources. And the primary purpose was to focus on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This was prior to the first Intifada. And this was during an era where it was believed that if the crisis with the Palestinians, the occupation, you know, the concerns that Israel had about the fact that its Arab neighbors were not acknowledging its right to exist, you know, that if these concerns could be resolved, then there would be peace in the Middle East. You know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was at the heart of it. And interestingly, I would say in the 90s and even the 2000s, the thought was the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would just go on for decades, and it was no longer the center of Middle Eastern conflict. And here we are now, and we're almost back to where we started from, where there's concerns about regional warfare after October 7th. So we're now an organization of more than 30 denominations that come together, committed to peace building. And what's amazing, Jeff, is these denominations, you know, I sometimes tease that we don't agree on anything, you know, theology, Christology, anyology. There's so many diverse differences as an ecumenical organization, and yet they've come together on 12 policy positions around peace building and human rights and justice. the sustainability of the church in the Middle East, and humanitarian and economic assistance. And so it's really beautiful, actually, to see the organization come together and work together towards peace.
Yes, indeed. That is just wonderful work that you're doing. I'm so grateful that the Presbyterian Church USA is also part of Churches for Middle East Peace. And it's a great concern for many of us, wherever we are on the theological spectrum. Now, at the time of our conversation here today, January 4th of 2024, Gaza officials are reporting that more than 22,000 people have been killed since Israel began its invasion of Gaza. And I know we should also report that this began when Hamas invaded Israel and brutally attacked and committed wars of aggression, crimes of aggression, and crimes of war against innocent Israeli civilians. I think killing about 1,200 folks is the number that's now being used. I know that you have many contacts there in Israel and Palestine. So what are you hearing from those folks who are on the ground?
We often talk about peace building specifically as it relates to Israelis and Palestinians. And one of the questions is, what's your starting point? And the date that you begin to talk about often changes the narrative or changes the story. And I do think it's critically important that we talk about October 7th, 2023, which was catastrophic for Jewish people in Israel. It validated a fear that Jewish people often live with. I was taught by an Israeli friend of mine. She said from the time she was a very little girl, Jewish people believe that their very existence is under threat. And we read about this in the Hebrew scriptures, you know, in Esther. We read about this, or we learn about this in history, you know, from the time of the Inquisition or the pogroms or, ultimately the culmination of the Holocaust. And so October 7th in so many ways validated these fears of the Jewish people of being under existential threat. And we hear from the Jewish community that Christians around the world don't understand that, but have not come alongside of them. And many in the Jewish community have had limited capacity or empathy or ability for any conversation outside of that context. But then there are profound Jewish leaders who've said, even if there's not room for empathy, there's room for morality, right? There's still room for another conversation to be had. And then there are courageous Jewish leaders who I think about, there was a woman named Vivian Silver who was killed on October 7th, who was one of the founders of Women Wage Peace. And she always said, violence is never going to bring peace for Israel. And she advocated for Palestinian rights. And her son now, even after his mother being killed by Hamas, is one of the leading voices for a ceasefire in Israel. And so we hear this diversity, amongst the Jewish community. And all of that is not even beginning to touch the decades of oppression that Palestinians experienced before October 7th, or the blockade that existed in Gaza for 16 years before October 7th, or, as you mentioned, what's happening in Gaza right now. And our main focus in this moment is to seek to be pastoral, as we're talking about that Jewish reality of what I just described, which is true for so many, while also ardently and actively and doing everything we can to call for an immediate comprehensive ceasefire to end what our 30 plus denominations have unilaterally agreed is the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And our goal is to prevent what could very easily become a genocide. And many people are saying is already a genocide. So just this last week, South Africa called on the International Court of Justice, which is you know, the body of the United Nations that and called on them and said that Israel is guilty of not preventing genocide. And so there's going to be a hearing. The first conversations about that are happening next week. There are genocide scholars and scholars of that know far more than I about, you know, the conventions and the legality and all of this. And there's little argument that there are leaders within the Israeli government that have genocidal intent in terms of their bombing and in terms of the ground incursion and in terms of what's happened in Gaza over the past, you know, now 90 days. Immediately after the 7th, I'm sure you know, water, gas, electricity turned off on more than 2 million people. 1.9 million people of a population of 2.3 million people in Gaza displaced. I mean, I could go on and talk about those realities. But our main goal right now is to stop the killing.
Yeah. So do you have any folks on the ground? I think I saw that you have at least one person in Jerusalem who works for CNET. Are there other folks that you're in contact with, and Christian leaders, obviously in the West Bank? But I don't know if you have others that might be in Gaza as well.
We don't have direct staff. We're a U.S.-based nonprofit on Capitol Hill. We do have staff in Egypt. We have staff in Jerusalem. We have many partners in Gaza, and so I'm in regular touch with contacts there. Lately, there have been days. I would say the first, the person that I'm most in touch with has responsibilities for an international development organization. They are a local Palestinian Gazan. They have access to an Israeli SIM card. So one of the things that has happened now, 6, 7, maybe even 8 times, I've lost count of the number, is that communications are often cut off in Gaza. And so that, of course, affects the distribution of humanitarian aid. It affects so many things. And I have been in touch most of the last 90 days every day. But in the last couple of weeks, the communication has dissipated to only every few days. And of course, the concern always is, you know, have those contacts and those people we loved and the people we know, you know, have they passed? Have they been killed? One of my closest friends in Beit Zahor in the district of Bethlehem, she's a Palestinian Christian who works at Bethlehem Bible College. Her aunt was killed early on in the bombing of the St. Porphyrius Church. And then just a couple of weeks after that, her uncle was in the Latin Catholic Church, the Holy Family Church. He had a medical crisis and could not get to the hospital, and he died. So we know people, almost all of the Palestinians we know either are connected to or have family members who've been killed. And of course, we know many Israelis who are connected to people who were killed or know people who were held hostage or are currently held hostage as well.
Yeah, there's so much heartbreak here. It's on all sides. But I guess I'm wondering, going back to the genocide issue for a moment, South Africa has filed this complaint with the International World Court, I believe, in The Hague. And I'm wondering if you think that that will have a positive outcome. Do you have any contacts that or insights into that as to how feasible that might be? And because so much of the time, you know, calls or accusations of genocide or war crimes just seem to go nowhere. And so I'm wondering if you have any insights about that.
One of the things we talk about as it relates to past genocides is that often they are only determined after the fact, which is, of course, incredibly problematic. And so that's why we talk about our main goal is to stop the deaths now, to end violence now, to end violence by Hamas. You know, we're calling for immediate release of the hostages. We just had a board member that was in Israel and Palestine over Christmas. He went with a delegation of, it wasn't quite two dozen international Christian leaders. The majority of them were from South Africa. And this is where I think I'll tell this story as a glimmer of hope on where can advocacy and our efforts of prayer, but also engagement be effective. So these international leaders went to stand in solidarity with Christians. They went to Bethlehem for Christmas. The Christmas celebrations were canceled, but services were not. And this group of mostly South Africans, but you know, our board member is an American. There were other internationals present. But these South African leaders in particular met with their ambassador. They met with former Israeli ambassadors to South Africa who are condemning the actions of Israel in Gaza. So these are Israelis who served in South Africa, who are familiar with apartheid, who are familiar with, you know, when you talk about ethnic cleansing, apartheid, genocide, you know, these are Israeli, you know, Jews who've served their country as diplomats. And one of the results, or we believe that one of the positive outcomes of this delegation of Christians who were present with the Christian community in Bethlehem was actually an impetus or an encouragement for South Africa's actions on, you know, bringing forward these charges before the International, you know, Court of Justice. And so that, I think, is deeply encouraging because it means our advocacy makes a difference. And I hope anyone listening, you know, we have been calling people to stand in the gap, and we have tons of resources on our website, Churches for Middle East Peace, www.cmep.org. And we're calling people to give to organizations that are immediately doing work for humanitarian assistance into Gaza, to give to organizations like ours that are doing education and prayer and spirituality and advocacy in DC, to give, act, and pray, to call on members of Congress. There is a movement within the Biden administration, within the White House, within the State Department, on Capitol Hill. There is a group of people that are serving our government that don't agree with President Biden's decisions, that don't agree. You know, we're seeing fellows and interns on Capitol Hill write letters that are public letters against the decisions of their bosses. There was just a letter that came out this fall that was fellows and interns on Capitol Hill that said, with all due respect, it's not our job to govern, but they said that the offices on Capitol Hill were ignoring all of the calls for ceasefires, that they were underestimating the number of calls, that they were ignoring kind of the cry of the American people to say, end this violence. You know, so give, act, and then pray. So we're having weekly prayer meetings. I do a weekly update every Thursday. That's 20 minutes of an update, and people can ask questions online. But I've been doing videos every single day since October 7th. That is a briefing that seeks to summarize what's happening, to give people information on how they can pray. So there's lots of ways that I think people can engage that can make a difference.
Yeah. Thank you. That's wonderful. Now, if folks wanted to join in that weekly update, where would they do that? Through the CMEP website?
All of that information's on the website. That's right. Mm-hmm. We have the links there. You just can go to our events, and
we'll try to include that in our show notes about this, because I think that could be very helpful. Let's take a break. And when we return, I'll ask the Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon about accusations of genocide. Stay with us.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
One of the other things that I find disturbing, I know that Israel has, or the prime minister has disavowed any accusations of genocide, but I think that it is alarming when Prime Minister Netanyahu makes references to the Amalekites, which is a case of genocide in the Hebrew scriptures, really under the cover of the demand of God to go and commit genocide against the Amalekites. So I fear that, and I think he said that, my recollection is that he said that in Hebrew, and so it kind of flies under the radar of most of the English-speaking world that supports Israel and wants to support Israel, wants to be assured, reassured, that they're not trying to wipe out the Palestinian population. Do you have any other thoughts about that?
Yes. I think, you know, when you look at the international human rights community, few have argued against the idea that there is clear genocidal intent, certainly by some Israeli officials, you know, if not by the vast majority. And so when you look at rhetoric and language that is coming from Smotrich or Ben-Gavir or Netanyahu or the Israeli military officials, language of the dehumanization of Palestinians, calling them animals or varmin, or, you know, this terminology that's so incredibly dehumanizing. There is an article that was written in Jewish Currents by a scholar named Roz Segal, who is a scholar. His background actually is genocide studies. And the title of the article is A Textbook Case of Genocide. And he makes the argument that it already is genocide. And he wrote this very, very early on, in early October. He is an associate professor of Holocaust and genocide studies. And it's interesting, the response article that's published is a letter response of someone who disagrees with him. And the person is Dove Waxman, who's also a professor, but of political science. And he says, it's not genocide yet, it's ethnic cleansing, but there's clear genocidal intent. And part of what we talk about at Churches for Middle East Peace is, honestly, it doesn't matter what you call it, thousands of people are dying. Just stop the killing. And so, you know, part of what I think it's important for people to understand is that Israel right now does have an existential threat. They have a problem where they have been trying to keep millions of Palestinians subjected to the oppressive control of a military occupation. And if October 7th teaches us anything, it teaches us that that does not work. And there was a powerful op-ed that was written by a mother whose soldier, whose oldest son was a soldier, and he was killed in Gaza. And she starts out his memorial by saying, if we think that trying to hold more than 2 million people under our thumb, you know, in, I don't know if she uses the language of, you know, an open air prison, but if we think that holding people under our control in Gaza is going to make us safe, we're fooling ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so Israel has this choice. They're trying to use military deterrence on millions of Palestinians to secure their safety, and it's backfiring. It's not working. So their choices are more violence, and, you know, the scriptures tell us violence begets violence. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. Or they have the choice of ethnic cleansing or genocide, or they have the choice of peace. And I think what most people don't understand is peace doesn't mean kumbaya. I mean, we're called idealistic all the time. Peace can be proximate peace. It doesn't mean you have to take down the separation barrier tomorrow. It can be incremental. It can be gradual. It can be steps of demilitarization. It can be steps of bringing in intermediary peacekeeping forces. And I don't know if you've seen this last week, there has been a hoopla between the Israeli government and the U.S. government, which has been Very, very reticent to challenge Israel on anything since October 7th. But two very right-wing Israeli leaders, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, have been talking about a solution to Gaza being displacing Palestinians and moving them to the Sinai.
Yes.
If you saw that whole conversation, I mean, it has been...
It's very disturbing.
Very disturbing. And the U.S. responded and just said, absolutely not. Palestinians don't want it. Palestinians have been displaced in 1948, 1967, multiple displacements. I mean, even the people in Gaza right now since October 7th have been displaced multiple times. And the concern is if they're moved out, many people would say, well, why not? They'd be safe. You know, that would keep them safe. But if they're moved out of Gaza, they will never be allowed back in. And so, you know, of course, King Abdullah of Jordan just flew to Egypt to meet with President Sisi because the Israelis asked the Egyptians to move their soldiers out of the Rafah area on the Egyptian side of the border with Gaza, presumably so that Israel could take control of that area, which is deeply disconcerting. I don't know if the Egyptian military complied. But there's deep concerns about that potential.
Well, and the prospect of ethnic cleansing amounts to another Nakba for the Palestinians, another catastrophe, and being displaced yet again. And, you know, the Palestinians in Jordan have been struggling for decades because they aren't really, they don't have a real home in Jordan because the Arab leaders from all the neighboring countries don't really want to accept them as regular citizens for fear that that would provide a precedent for further ethnic cleansing from Palestine or other places.
So that's right. That's right.
I think there's
Palestinians,
concern there.
Yes. My understanding is that 70% of Jordanian citizens are actually of Palestinian descent. So many Palestinians do hold Jordanian passports. Many do not. Many are still refugees. Some still live in refugee camps in Lebanon. But there are, of course, Palestinian refugee camps. I mean, I've been in them, Burj Al Barajna in Lebanon. You know, Lebanon is one of the worst places where Palestinians have not been absorbed, just as you described. The Palestinian refugee population is at more than 5 million people globally. It's one of the largest refugee populations in the world and is the only refugee population that has its own division of the United Nations, UNRWA, designated for its care.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people.